Woody Guthrie wrote thousands of songs in his lifetime, but as far as anyone knows, he only wrote one novel. That novel, which just recently was discovered, is being published by another artist, actor Johnny Depp.
He recently partnered with HarperCollins to create his own imprint, his own brand of books. And Guthrie's novel, called House of Earth, is the first book published under that imprint.
The novel tells the story of a young couple in the Texas panhandle of the 1930s. They dream of building a house that will stand up to the bitter winds and ever-present dust that constantly threaten their flimsy wooden shack.
Sounds a little like a Woody Guthrie song. And as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, the novel grew out of a little-known passion of Guthrie's.
It was Johnny Depp's publishing partner, historian and author Douglas Brinkley, who tracked down the lost novel after he stumbled across a reference to it while doing research. When he sat down to read it, Brinkley could hear the same Woody Guthrie he had grown to love through his music.
Woody Guthrie has something that every artist dies for, a voice. You can read House of Earth and you know it's Woody Guthrie. You know it's coming from the heart.
When Woody Guthrie's daughter Nora Guthrie first read the book, she had a different reaction.
Whoa. Whoa. The opening chapter was so sexy. I just went, whoa, Dad. Where are you going with this?
Both Brinkley and Guthrie suspect that, in part, it is the sexually explicit material in the book that kept it from being published after it was written in 1947. And there was another reason. The book would have come out just as an era of virulent anti-communism was getting underway. So it was also most likely that politics kept it from being published. Because, Brinkley says, the book is both a love story and a polemic against the bankers and businessmen who Guthrie blamed for keeping the poor poor, a theme often heard in his music.
Was a farming on the shares and always I was poor. My crops I lay into the banker's store. My wife took down and died up on the cabin floor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
House of Earth is the story of struggling young sharecroppers Tyke and Ella May. Nora Guthrie says her father has created a portrait of their life, sowing seeds, planting crops, making love, giving birth, and dreaming of creating a safe haven amid the dust storms and economic depression of the 1930s.
These ideas of seeds and sex and procreation and earth and, you know, farm language and things like that, adobe houses, you know, being built out of this combination of water and earth. That's what really struck me, you know, once again, how he just hammers home this really rough and rich life.
Tyke is determined to build a new house made of adobe, convinced that such a house will give them better protection from the unrelenting weather. Nora Guthrie says this idea of building adobe homes was one of her father's obsessions.
He was fascinated with this whole idea of people being able to cheaply create homes that were stronger than the wooden homes that were being devastated during the Dust Bowl. So he had this long-term fascination, and when he had fascinations, he turned them into everything. He turned it into art, he turned it into letters, he turned it into lyrics.
Well, I'll grab some mud and you grab some clay, so when it rains it won't wash away. We'll build a house that'll be so strong, the winds will sing my baby a song. Bling, blang, hammer with my hammer, zing, go, zang.
There are passages in the novel where you can hear Woody Guthrie, the lyricist. He plays with words, veers into poetry, wanders off into stream of consciousness. Brinkley says the book does not have a strong narrative, but Guthrie makes deft use of language to bring his characters to life.
And he's able to really do a great job of capturing dialects and the slang expressions of a region, but it's done with a poetic flourish. You can almost speed read the novel out loud, and when you do, there's a musicality to it.
In this passage, Ella May reacts with scorn to Tyke's suggestion that they build a new adobe home.
A house, her voice rose, of earth. Tyke only listened. His throat was so tight that no words could get out. A house of earth, and not an inch of earth to build it on. There was a quiver, a tremble, and a shake in her body as she scraped her shoe sole against the ground. Oh, yes, she said, in a way that made fun of them both, of the whole farm. Mocked the old farm shed, shamed the iron water tank, made fun of all the houses that lay within her sight.
Brinkley says the themes of House of Earth are reflected in Guthrie's most famous song, This Land Is Your Land, especially in lyrics like these, which are not heard in most popular versions of the song.
There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. Sign was painted, said private property, but on the back side it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me.
Woody believed that the people that lived on the land should own the land. So he was outraged at what bankers were doing and what people were struggling and they couldn't pay rents and were being forced off the land. And so This Land Is Your Land and House of Earth are both aimed at people being able to say, if you grew up on a property, it should be yours and you should be able to live on it. But instead, many people didn't have money and were forced off the land.
This land was made for you and me.
Brinkley says though this book was written in 1947 and set in the Depression era, it is as relevant today as it was then.
You know, this novel takes place everywhere. It happens to be in Texas, but this book echoes, you know, for global shanty towns in many ways and the need to try to find the dignity of dwelling and shelter.
In the end, Guthrie leaves the reader with a lot of unanswered questions about the fate of his characters. And that makes sense, Brinkley says, because real life is messy and rarely gets resolved in a tidy package, especially if you're poor. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Back in 1927, I had a little farm and I called it heaven. Price was up and the rain come down and I hauled my crops all into town. I got the money.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Fed the kids, took it easy. Rain it quit and the wind got high and the black old dust storms filled the sky and I swapped my farm for a Ford machine and I filled it full of this gas I lean and started.
Let's venture now into the realm of fantasy conjured up by one of the most beloved authors of children's picture books. Maurice Sendak captured the wonders and fears, the lightness and dark of childhood. The author of Where the Wild Things Are was 83 when he died last spring, and he left behind a new work. My brother's book reads like a poem, a meditation on life and death and longing.
It's probably the only thing that Maurice wrote and published that is perhaps more for adults than for children.
That's Angels in America playwright Tony Kushner, a longtime friend. And over the years, Maurice Sendak discussed the project with him.
It's a poem that he wrote and then kept in his drawer, waiting for what he felt would be the right time to turn it into a book. I really feel that in a way it's a book that he intended for those of us who grew up reading Maurice and who loved his work. It's a kind of a farewell for us.
That farewell is illustrated in a dreamscape of bright watercolors. My brother's book is a kind of love letter to those who've gone before, beginning with Maurice Sendak's brother Jack, who died 18 years ago. The story follows two brothers, Jack and Guy, separated when a falling star crashes to Earth. And also, Maurice Sendak places himself in the story. He calls himself Guy.
Sort of, although I think that actually Guy is both Maurice and Maurice's partner, Eugene Glynn, whose illness and death was a terrible ordeal and a terrible loss for Maurice. They'd been together for 50 years. And it's like a lot of Maurice's books, a story of separation and then reunion after a series of difficult and perilous adventures.
Would you read for us the first few pages?
Sure. It's hard to read it because Maurice read it to me many, many times while he was thinking of starting work on it. And so I hear his voice, and he read so beautifully. Anyway, I'll try. On a bleak midwinter's night, the newest star, blazing light, so crystal bright, eclipsing the moon, scorching the sky, smashed and heaved the iron earth in two, catapulting Jack to continents of ice, a snow image stuck fast in water like stone. His poor nose froze. While Guy wheeled round in the steep air, a crescent in the sky, passing worlds at every plunge, dropping down and down on soft Bohemia into the lair of a bear who hugged Guy tight to kill his breath and eat him bite by bite.
It's hard to hear that line and eat him bite by bite and not think of Marie Sendak's book, Where the Wild Things Are.
Right, and where Max says, I'll eat you up.
I'll eat you up to his mother.
Right, and which gets him in a lot of trouble. And there's a lot of consuming and devouring and eating in Maurice's books. And I think that when people play with kids, there's a lot of fake ferocity and threats of, you know, devouring because love is so enormous, the only thing you can think of doing is swallowing the person that you love entirely. One of my favorite drawings of Maurice, it's pretty well known, it's a fantasy sketch, and it shows a baby opening its mouth wider and wider and wider, and then its mother sort of jumps in its mouth and disappears head first entirely inside the baby, and the baby is sitting there at the end a little bit fatter with a big smile on its face.
I mean, of course, this is all the stuff of the really original fairy tales.
Yeah, absolutely.
These primal scenes.
Yeah. I mean, what I think is great about Maurice is the people that he borrows from are fairly adult artists. William Blake, Herman Melville, William Shakespeare, John Keats, his pantheon of heroes, Mozart, who meant everything to him, and opera in general, Maurice really loved. Verdi was a figure that haunted Maurice a lot. He was very worried that he really wanted to do with this book what he felt Verdi had done at the end of his life with Falstaff, that in his early 80s, Verdi broke a long silence and composed, you know, one of the great comic operas. And Maurice was hoping that this book, my brother's book, would be sort of his farewell masterpiece. But I think that the borrowing from these people, his indebtedness to adult artists is recognizable. He doesn't really borrow from fairy tales as much as generate, I think, his fairy tales from the same sources. I mean, his psyche was really an open book.
Would you mind going to the last part of this poem? And it's Guy and Jack has gone to this other place. And Guy, who, as you would say, is partly Maurice Sendak and partly his life's partner, who also has fallen into a different world.
Right. Guy saw Jack's nose and rooted toes, deep buried in veiled blossoms, and he bit that nose, to be sure. Just lost when I am saved, Jack sighed, and his arms, as branches will, wound round his noble-hearted brother, who he loves more than his own self. And Jack slept safe, enfolded in his brother's arms, and Guy whispered, good night, and you will dream of me.
To the degree that this was Maurice Sendak, this character, Guy, whispering good night, was this in a way his way of writing his own ending, the place to he goes to, the reunions with his loves?
I think so. I mean, Maurice, actually, when he was a little boy, used to bite Jack's nose. He also, after Jean died, dreamt of Jean night after night after night, pretty much to the end of his life, which is why I really feel that the book is a goodbye from him to everybody who loved him, which was a lot of people.
Tony Kushner, thank you for sharing these stories with us about your friend Maurice Sendak.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's writer Tony Kushner speaking on behalf of Maurice Sendak, who died last May, and who has a new book out, published posthumously, called My Brother's Book. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm David Green. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. And how healthy is the traditional book publishing industry? On yesterday's program, we heard from Mark Coker, who says big New York publishing houses had better watch out.
When we look out at the evolution of the publishing industry over the next few years, traditional publishers are going to become more and more irrelevant.
Mark Coker is in self-publishing. His company, Smashwords, distributes thousands of self-published books. And today, he and other self-publishing evangelists are pointing to a new feature on the Apple iBook Store. It's called Breakout Books, and it highlights self-published titles that have already gotten high ratings from readers. So what do big publishers have to say about all the growth in self-publishing? We asked Michael Peach to talk with us about that. He's a prominent editor who worked with an impressive range of famous writers, from the late David Foster Wallace to the bestseller James Patterson. In April, Peach takes on a new challenge, CEO of Hachette Publishing Group. He told us companies like Smashwords are a great addition to the world of books, but they don't replace traditional publishing.
I love that variety, I love that opportunity, and I love the diversity of publication that is possible now. But I object strenuously to the notion that publishers are irrelevant, because publishers are doing things now that are extraordinarily complex, exciting. I think we're in a golden age for books, reading, writing, and publishing, and the ways that publishers can work to connect readers with writers now are the kinds of things that publishers have dreamt of doing since Gutenberg first put down a line of type.
So give me some examples. What are you doing that's so different from what I assume publishers do, which is find good books and get them out there into the market?
That hasn't changed. That's always been the way publishers have made money, is by selecting books in which there's an interest and then getting people's attention for those books. What has changed in a really exciting way is the ways you can get people's attention. It used to be one book review at a time, a daily review, you know, maybe you get into Time magazine. Now there's, with the internet, this giant echo chamber. Anything good that happens, any genuine excitement that a book elicits, can be amplified and repeated and streamed and forwarded and linked in a way that excitement spreads more quickly and universally than ever before. It's just energized the whole business in a thrilling way.
So here's the thing that I want you to help us understand. What do we make of the fact that big publishers are now plucking self-published writers from bestseller lists and then giving them contracts? I mean, by then, the artist has already done their work. The word of mouth has already happened. And it seems like you guys are kind of swooping in to benefit from that. That same person could get all that press and all that stuff because their work has risen to the top.
That is a good question, and you have to ask, well, why does each of those writers choose to go with a major publisher throughout history? The press loves to pick up the story of the writer who sold the book out of the trunk of their car, or out of their garage, and then made it into a mainstream publishing deal, as happened recently with E.L. James, famously, and hugely.
And E.L. James, of course, the author of 50 Shades of Grey.
Yes.
Five people out there who might not have read it at this point.
But think, why do writers then choose to come to a publisher? For marketing. They want someone who can help them take what they've created and get it everywhere. And the business of publishing has become much more complex. You're not just selling books to local bookstores. You're selling them to Costco, to Target, to Walmart, to Urban Outfitters, to this huge, complicated physical book network. And at the same time, on all the digital retail platforms that are out there. And that's what a publisher orchestrates. A publisher, when it's going well, gets that book in the front of the store, on the homepage of the website, at the moment that that writer is sitting down with Audie Cornish on All Things Considered to talk about her book.
Now, publishing houses, in a way, are like all of the other big media gatekeepers out there. You know, news organizations, I think we're being questioned about our judgment, whether it's, you know, record companies are being questioned about whether they can really tell us who's going to be the next big thing. Do you think that this is just part of the breaking down of that wall, that like you aren't the gatekeeper or the curator anymore? The consumer is, the reader is.
We are gatekeepers to a certain extent, but the really, really big gates. You know, the number of titles that publishers have brought out have exploded over the past couple of decades. The really interesting change is finding which books you can bring attention to and how you get people to talk about them and what can be done to get conversations going through Facebook and Twitter and all these other emerging networks. And out of the thousands, tens of thousands of books out there, find the ones that you can really bring more readers to.
So in about 2 months, you're actually going to move into the CEO's office at Hachette. And obviously, you're probably doing a lot of preparation for that now. But what's the best advice you've gotten about making that transition, especially for someone like you who's best associated with editing books, you know, rather than running a company?
The best advice I've had is from our CEO in France, Arnaud Nourry, who is the chairman of Hachette Livre, who said, don't try to be your predecessor. You have this job because of who you are and the skills you have. You're a publisher. You're an editor. Don't try to pretend you have 35 years of experience in supply chain management. You don't. That's not why you're here. Your job is to find the best writers in the world and bring them here and give them the best publishing experience they can have. And to me, that's a great charge.
Not to have you do too much analysis, but do you think that's why you were selected to run Hachette? Because it seems as though they might want someone who could bring them into the brave new world of digital and e-readers and, you know, money. And do you think that it says something about where publishers think their role is going to be going forward?
I think there are two aspects to that. One is, I love the business of publishing. I've been an editor, editor-in-chief, publisher, and in every step I've learned more about the finances and the business and where you can make money and where you can save money and how a business grows. So I'm not a financial naive. At the same time, this is a moment when the questions that you started this conversation with, can writers publish themselves, should they publish themselves, are publishers necessary, are in the air constantly. And it is important to have, for Hachette, to have the person running the company be someone who answers that question immediately.
Michael, I want to ask you one more question, which I feel like I need to ask anyone who's in the business of reading books at all these days, which is, do you read on a digital device?
I read on every kind of surface that you can imagine. A publisher
But
in
do
this
you
age,
have a preference? When you curl up at home, what are you curling up with? Is it glowing or is it crinkling?
It depends on the night. Sometimes I read on my iPhone because the iPhone glows in the dark and doesn't require that I keep the bedside light on. But last night I had a big old hardcover book that fell out of my hands when I fell asleep.
Well, Michael Peach, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Peach currently runs Little Brown, a division of Hachette Publishing Group. In April, he'll become Hachette's CEO.
In the 1970s, a young man named Paul Haggis was walking down a street in Ontario, Canada. He encountered a man peddling a book.
He handed the book to Paul and he said, "You've got a mind. This is the owner's manual." And inside there was a stamp saying Church of Scientology. And Paul was intrigued and he said, "Take me there."
That's how the journalist Lawrence Wright begins the story of Paul Haggis. A central character in Going Clear, Wright's new book about the Church of Scientology. Haggis became a member of that church. He moved to Hollywood. The church's deep penetration of the movie industry helped his career as a screenwriter, and he went on to win Oscars for Crash and Million Dollar Baby. Yet he told Lawrence Wright of a disturbing experience when Haggis was allowed to read some of the deepest secrets of this religion. He was admitted to a tightly secured room to read pages by L. Ron Hubbard, the science fiction writer who founded the church.
And in there, he talks about Xenu, the galactic overlord, who at one point had ruled the universe. And it was a universe actually very similar to ours, but very overcrowded. And Xenu had to depopulate the universe. So he brought in a number of people, ostensibly for tax audits, and froze them.
Haggis found this story of the universe to be madness, his word, but he stayed in the Church of Scientology for years before he left it. Lawrence Wright interviewed Haggis while exploring the mystery of why people remain in that church.
At a basic level, Scientology sounds like, I don't know, Freudian psychology or something like that. It sounds like it's just talking, but it got more elaborate the more deeply that Paul Haggis got in.
Yes, indeed. There's a little difference between ordinary therapy and Scientology therapy, which is called auditing. Between you and your auditor, there's a device. It's called an e-meter, and it's really one-third of a lie detector. You hold two metal cans in your hand. When Paul joined the church, they were Campbell's soup cans with the labels scraped off. So imagine that you're with your therapist, but there's a lie detector. Now, that raises the stakes considerably. If you believe in the validity of this machine, in Scientology, they say it measures the mass of your thoughts. If you believe that it's telling you the truth what other people say about Scientology, the jokes they might make about its theology and those sorts of things, that's not going to reach you. You've had transforming experiences.
Is that brainwashing?
There is a form of thought control in Scientology that is especially pronounced in its clergy. It's called the Sea Org. And many of them live inside a compound in Southern California in the desert. The world outside is not very well known to them. They've set aside their education. They're impoverished by their service. Many of them have all their family members inside Scientology. And if they were to try to leave, no one in Scientology would ever speak to them again. Then they're given a bill for services rendered, often amounting to hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if they decide to run away, usually, there's a team that goes after them and tracks them down and brings them back. And they are sometimes, frequently, put in involuntary confinement in re-education camps, sometimes for years on end.
You recount an occasion in the 1970s in which the FBI discovered that the Church of Scientology had been gathering information illicitly on a variety of people. They began raiding Scientology properties. They burst in on a building. They find dozens of people in one of these re-education camps. They're being punished from the outside. You might think they're being degraded. Here's a bunch of FBI agents, and yet you write that not a single one of those people took the opportunity to escape or report on the church.
That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the reasons that one of the subtitles of my book, Going Clear, is The Prison of Belief, is that it's their belief, their own will, that holds people in Scientology, even oftentimes when they have been abused.
And yet at the same time, you write of a man who, although he was clearly deeply financially committed to this church and deeply interested in it, could never quite bring himself to entirely believe.
It's true. You know, I think this is probably true of a lot of people in different religions.
Why did Haggis stay so long if he found it to be madness, in his word?
He was glued into the community. You know, his family was all deeply involved in it. It had helped him in his career. He felt that some of what they call technology in Scientology, which is its approach to human behavior, had been helpful to him. And there was not a triggering event for him to leave until Proposition 8 came along. That was the proposition in California to ban gay marriage. And as it happens, Paul has two gay daughters. One of his daughters discovered that a church affiliated with Scientology had signed the petition supporting Proposition 8, and that outraged Paul, and he demanded that the church renounce it, and they wouldn't. And so he began an investigation. And for the first time, a celebrity member of the church actually decided to take a look at what people were saying about the church, about the allegations of abuse that surrounded it, and he was shocked. And he decided he's going to have to leave and leave noisily, as he said, sending an email to about 20 of his Scientology friends with his resignation.
You give some figures for the Church of Scientology in the early pages of the book. The dollar figures seem very high.
Yeah, $1 billion in liquid assets.
The numbers of people do not seem all that.
They're impoverished in that regard. And I think they are hemorrhaging members. Certainly, I've talked to a lot of former members who've left the church recently. The two things Scientology has on its side are money and lawyers. But those qualities won't save it if it can't find a way to bring new members into the fold.
Although that raises another question for you. You recount how reporters, such as an investigative journalist for Time magazine, when they reported unflattering things about the church, they've been sued to the farthest extent they can be sued, whether there was a case or not.
That's true. That was the most expensive suit Time ever defended.
So are they going to come after you?
Well, we've had a lot of letters from lawyers. But, you know, I went into this with my eyes open. I've been careful, and I've done what I can to query the church about factual matters. It's been a very difficult relationship with them, often very hostile in tone on their part. But the thing is, it's an irresistible story. And for someone like me, the risk was worth it.
Lawrence Wright is the author of Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Thanks very much.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Steve.
Rosie Schapp is a part-time bartender, and she writes the drinks column for the New York Times Magazine. But she doesn't hang out in bars just to make a living, or even just to have a drink. In a new memoir called Drinking with Men, Schapp writes about how the time she has spent in bars has shaped her life, starting when she was just 15 years old, hanging around the bar car of a New York City commuter train.
I was really into tarot cards and all kinds of mysticism, or at least a 15-year-old's ideas about mysticism. Hmm. And one night, because I was so preoccupied with really learning tarot cards, I just pulled them out on that bar car to practice. And suddenly all these grown-ups who hadn't given me a second glance before kind of swooped in on me and wanted me to tell their fortunes.
Oh, that's interesting. These are all commuters from New York, like coming back
from
work.
These were all commuters. These were all, you know, but bar car commuters, as I'm sure you know, are different from other commuters.
Uh-huh.
They're louder.
Okay.
Drunker, smokier. All of these things. And that's what really drew me to the bar car.
What'd you like about it?
They just seemed to be having such a good time, and they really seemed like a community.
Okay, and so you really get addicted to the sense of community as a teenager.
I did.
In the bar car. You title your book Drinking with Men, and over the years, you've mostly been with men. I mean, that's who you're usually drinking with.
That's true. There are many women with whom I have loved drinking over the years. But the truth is, in any bar, any good corner neighborhood bar, most of the regulars will be men.
And in some ways, it seemed like one thing you were doing in this book was saying, I'm a woman, I love bars, I love even dive bars, and that's okay.
It's absolutely okay. For me, it's been very good. And I don't want to sound naive about it, but the vast majority of my experience in bars has been so good. I've learned about books, I've learned about art, I've learned about sports. Most interesting of all, I've learned about the lives of other people who've really let me into their own experiences because we happen to drink together in the same place.
One person who became very important to you was a man you met at a bar. His name was Ed, and I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about him.
Every now and then you meet someone who really just completely informs and changes your experience of a bar. And Ed was that kind of guy. I think sometimes when we think about the kind of exchange of conversation in a bar, it can be almost a cacophony, all of these different voices. Ed was just this very rare listener. And I needed that at that time. I was in my mid to late 20s, and my life felt kind of untethered in many ways. And it never felt like I was burdening him.
Rosie, do you have the book with you?
I do.
There's a passage on page 165, and we should say Ed passed away, and it was a really painful moment for you. And you were telling a friend about why this friend of yours from the bar was so important to you, and she wasn't totally getting it. Maybe you could read some from the book.
Sure. She was not unsympathetic, but she looked a little puzzled, like it was strange that I should be so invested in someone I knew from a bar, someone I drank with. I hadn't grown up with Ed. He was not a relative, though he was family in a way that was suddenly too hard to explain. We had not gone to school together. We had never worked together. We knew each other because, night after night, for just a couple of years, we drank in each other's company.
Are you a little puzzled yourself about how someone you met in a bar could become so special?
I think I was at the time. I think I hadn't expected that. But it's happened many times since then.
Do you think if everyone gave the bar culture a chance, they would see this community and experience these types of friendships? Or does it take a unique person? I mean, are you unique in some way where the bar culture is right for you?
I think that bar culture can offer something to everyone. You know, when I invite friends of mine who don't spend as much time in bars as I do, they always have a great time, and they get it, and they see how supportive we are of one another and how we really do, as fellow regulars, just help each other let off that steam. If you're not a true regular, you might not see the need to come back the next night and the next and the next. I think that's really the difference.
There were a few times, Rosie Schapp, where you asked yourself, does my frequent attendance at bars mean that I might be an alcoholic?
Sure. I think if I never asked myself that question, I'd probably be in trouble.
And what is your answer?
My answer is no, I'm not an alcoholic. I think it's good that I've had to sit and think about that. But it's never been hard for me not to drink alcohol. It's been hard for me not to go to bars. And there is a difference.
I wonder, this is a memoir, and in your acknowledgments, and it's the only place that this comes up, you mentioned that you lost your husband in 2010.
I did.
I guess I just wonder, has that loss changed your relationship with bars and what you need from bars at all?
You know, I hadn't thought about that really, David. That's a good question. And I think it has. I was writing the book and living with a spouse with a terrible kind of cancer. You really need to be on your toes when someone you love is dying. There's a lot to deal with.
Yeah.
So I kind of needed to have that end of night drink to sort of let a little bit of that go at the end of the day. But I couldn't drink very much at that time. I had too much to do. And since then, you know, I don't know if it's just because of losing Frank, but I think also just getting older. You know, now I stop by my favorite local bars less than I once did. I don't stay as long, but it's still so important to me that they're there. And since you mentioned Frank and his death, I hadn't really thought about bartending in many, many years until after he died. And it was a time when it was really hard for me to just get myself up in the morning and do normal things like shower and get dressed and go out and see people. And I think the people who own the bar where I work kind of offered me a shift as a kind of mitzvah, as a way to get me out, as a way to talk to people again and have a reason for getting out there more. And it's been a real blessing in that way. I've seen a lot of really, really big hearts in bars.
Rosie Schaff, thank you so much for talking to us about your life and about your book. It's been a pleasure.
David, I couldn't have enjoyed it more. I hope we can do it again someday over drinks.
I like that idea. Rosie Schaff, her new memoir is called Drinking with Men. And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News, where everybody knows your name. Mine is David Greene.
I knew that. I'm Steve Inskeep.